Tanto.
Okay, we'll begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we will be taking sutta number 32 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the larger discourse in the Gosinga forest. And this is on page 307. I think just about all of you have come up what is called the Bodhi Walk in front of the big Buddha hall. And you see there are statues of 18 great disciples of the Buddha there. And what do you notice about these 18 statues? Don't say that they're made out of stone. What is particularly striking about them?
Their expressions, they're all different.
Okay, say that again.
Their expressions, and they're all different.
The expressions are all different. And maybe the expression is a key to something more than just the face, but you could say that the expression of the face is a key to what? Well, yeah, but something a little more persistent. Sometimes I don't know if I phrase the question.
Personality?
Say again?
Personality.
Exactly, exactly. So there are different expressions on the face, not only on the face, but different. The body is held in different ways. Some of them are sitting very serenely, very relaxed. Some like look like they're bursting with electrical energy. Some look, the facial expression looks almost violent, even though they're arahats, so they have no more hatred or ill will, but very fierce, intense expression on the face. Some look very calm and tranquil. Some are engaged in meditation. Some look like they're engaged in teaching. Some look like they're engaged in a debate or an argument. And there's one statue that you have to see it in the winter when it's snowing. It's actually the statue of Mahabhogalala. Has the, yeah, it's the right hand like this. When it's snowing, the snow builds up in the hand. But when you pass by, it looks like he's about to throw a snowball at you. Okay, so all of these disciples all have basically the same enlightenment, the same realization, the same liberation. So there's no difference between the enlightenment of one, the enlightenment of the others, between the liberation of one, the liberation of the others. But it's just like, maybe to use an analogy, it's just like having the same sunlight pass through different stained glass windows. So the image that will appear on the window is different because of the configuration, the color of the pieces of glass on the window, but the light shining through them is all the same. And so we find quite interestingly that the great disciples of the Buddha, though they all have the same enlightenment, the same realization, same liberation, but their characters are very different, depending probably upon the accumulation of different tendencies, different interests, different proclivities, different styles of cultivation over many previous lives. And so in this sutta on the larger discourse in the Gosinga forest, we're going to see how each of or a number of disciples expresses his own understanding of what will be an ideal monk. Okay, so the sutta begins with the Buddha is living in this Gosinga solitary forest together with a number of the most prominent elder disciples. There was the Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, the Venerable Mahakasapa, the Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, and other prominent elder disciples. And of the ones mentioned here, we have stone statues along the walkway of Sariputta, Moggallana, Revata, Anuruddha, Ananda. Five of them are represented by statues. The two of them who are so prominent we don't have statues, that is Mahakasapa and Venerable Ananda. Does anybody know why those two? There are no statues of those two disciples. You're wrong.
I can only guess that Ananda didn't get the Mahakasapa, so he's the last one
to survive. Well, he got his arahatship after the Buddha's passing away, but I think he could have been represented there. And certainly Mahakasapa isn't represented. Bo Wei, do you know why?
Yes.
Robert,
because it depends on who made those statues. Maybe it didn't go to the Shaolin Temple.
Maybe it didn't.
It didn't go to Shaolin Temple.
To Shaolin Temple.
Yeah. Because I think the 18th Arhat's idea came from Shaolin Temple.
Nobody has. Anybody else have an idea? I have an idea. I'm not sure whether it's right or not. I thought maybe one of you would be more authoritative on this than I am. But I could just offer a guess. In this respect, Zhuangyan maybe is a little different from the typical Chinese temple. But I think in most Chinese temples, on the altar, along with the statue of Sakyamuni Buddha, don't they usually have statues of Ananda and Mahakasapa? They don't?
No, that's the southern tradition, that's in Sri Lanka. I think mostly in the Chinese temple you have the two Bodhisattvas.
I know you have Manjushri and Manjushri and Puxin.
One is on
Yeah.
And the other is
fine.
Yeah, I know. Maybe somebody on
the internet now. It's a good question. I remember when I first went to Asia, the first country that I went to was Vietnam, because I was originally ordained as a Vietnamese monk. And I remember in the temple where I was staying in Vietnam, right up alongside they had the Buddha Shakyamuni, not the Amitabha Buddha. And next to Shakyamuni Buddha, there were statues of Ananda and Mahakasapa and Ananda. I don't recall the 18 arhats in that temple, but it struck me that perhaps in a certain period, maybe of Chinese history, or maybe even going back to Indian history, they would have images. This would be the Sarvastivada school emphasizes the apostolic transmission through Mahakasapa to Ananda. Whereas in the Theravada tradition, two monks will be up in the front with the Buddha will be Sariputta and Mahamoggallana. But I think in the northern tradition, they don't put the two chief disciples, but rather the two disciples who are considered to have been the first two patriarchs. Maybe I'm stepping into waters where I'm not qualified to swim. But that's what occurred to me to explain the absence of Ananda and Mahakasapa amongst the 18 statues. Otherwise, I don't know the explanation. But maybe I'll ask, perhaps Fa Yao Fa Sher might know. I'll ask him at lunchtime if I see him. Okay, anyway, let us return to the text. Okay, so one evening, the Venerable Mahamoggallana comes out from his meditation. And he goes to Venerable Mahakasapa and says to him, "Friend Kasapa, let us go to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma." Okay, so Moggallana, Mahakasapa go to the Venerable Sariputta, and as they're walking, probably through a path in the forest, where does Venerable Anuruddha appears at some point to join them? Then Venerable Ananda sees them walking along the path, and he joins them. He goes to the Venerable Revata and says, "Let us go join them." and listen to the Venerable Sariputta. Okay, so they all gather around the place where Venerable Sariputta is staying. Okay, then they're all settled there in paragraph 4. Then Venerable Sariputta speaks, he addresses the Venerable Ananda, and he says that this Gosenga, the word Gosenga actually means cow's horn. Perhaps the forest was shaped like a cow's horn. So it's this Gosenga solitary wood is delightful. It's probably a full moon night, so the night is lit by moonlight. And the sal trees are all in blossom. And the sal trees, the flowers, the sal flowers have a very sweet scent. And so it seems as though heavenly scents are floating in the air. Then Sariputta asks Ananda, what kind of monk could illuminate this Gosenga sal tree forest? What kind of monk would shine or beautify or adorn? I think that would be actually a better rendering. What kind of bhikkhu would adorn this Gosenga sal tree wood? Okay, so now Ananda is going to answer in a way which is sort of determined by his own aptitudes, his own interests, his own proclivities. Do you remember Venerable Ananda amongst all of the disciples of the Buddha? What was he pointed, the Buddha pointed him out as being a chief disciple in a particular respect? In what respect was that?
Great memory, learning, and erudition.
Wow. Great memory?
Learning and erudition.
Well, learning and erudition,
it's
I think.
The same thing.
Yeah. But great memory and great erudition. There's also something else. I think great retention. Well, actually, retention is the same as memory. Great. Gatti, ditti is something like practical wisdom.
Guardian of the Dhamma.
That was, he was appointed, that's the word used, the expression used to describe him in the commentaries is guardian of the Dhamma. I'm not sure that it occurs in the suttas at all, but it's because of his memory, his erudition, his capacity for his retention, and his practical intelligence that he was called the guardian of the Dharma. And so Ananda had a special function because of his great memory and because he always lived very close to the Buddha. So he served something as the treasurer of the Dharma. And so whenever the Buddha would give a discourse, Venerable Ananda would immediately be listening and be able to retain it in his mind and to relate it to the other monks. And if for some reason Ananda could not be present when the Buddha gave a discourse, he had made a request of the Buddha always to repeat the discourse when they met it on a later occasion, and then Ananda would preserve it. And so in this way, in the Theragata, Ananda says that I have heard 84,000, or I have preserved 84,000 bundles of Dhamma. He says, I learned 82,000 from the Buddha and 2,000 from the disciples. Of course, the figure 84,000 shouldn't be taken too literally. It's almost a symbolic figure in Indian, at least in Buddhist literature, to represent a great number. Okay, so Ananda is going to speak according to his own interests and capacities. And so he says, here, friend Sariputta, a monk has learned much. He remembers what he has learned, and he consolidates, or this expression could also mean stores up, accumulates what he has learned. So he remembers it and he stores it up and perhaps organizes it into some kind of systematic whole. I mean, because if you remember so many things, you can't keep your mind like like Bhante's bookshelf with the books just placed wherever they happen to wind up, but you have to organize it like a library. You know, the discourses on this topic, five aggregates here, discourses on the sense bases here, discourses on dependent origination there, discourses on Satipatthana there, and so on. Such teachings as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and the right phrasing. So these are two important aspects of the Buddha's teaching. These are words which he used again and again to describe the Buddha's teaching. He said that the teaching is with atta means meaning. So the teaching of a Buddha, it has to be meaningful. And also the word atta has another meaning besides meaning, which also is significant. It means benefit or good. Benefit, goodness, profit, not in a material, not in a monetary sense, but being profitable or beneficial. And the word atta also means goal, pointing to the goal, which for the Buddha's teaching is nibbana. And so the Buddha's teaching is with meaning, it's meaningful because it's beneficial, and it's beneficial because it leads to one's welfare and happiness and culminates in the goal. And then the teaching is also with the right bhyanjana, which means sometimes the word bhyanjana in relation to food, it means the different side dishes that accompany the rice. Like in a typical Indian meal, sort of the main staple is the rice, could be chapati, but actually in the Buddha's time it was clearly rice. And then there would be other dishes along the side, and those are called bhyanjana. Anybody from an Indian background? Do you use that expression in Pakistan? Nothing. What language do you use?
Urdu and Hindi is the same.
Urdu.
And Hindi is the same.
Same. And you don't use bhyanjana or bhyanjana? What do you call the side dishes? In Urdu, what are the side dishes called?
They're usually named by whatever it is.
But there's not a general name for them?
There is no general name, not that I know of. But you know, I'm no authority. It's generally named by whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
In Andhra Pradesh, if you ask somebody to a meal, you invite them to rice. And the side dishes are the curries.
Yeah, but I think, is curry a British expression?
Well, in Andhra Pradesh people use it.
In Andhra Pradesh.
It's salad in
southern India.
No, it's
shortening is salam.
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 Hmm. Okay, anyway. I guess languages change. Okay, so in relation to language, vyanjana is the expression, the formulation or the phrasing. And so the Buddha's teaching has to have not only the right meaning, but it has to be expressed properly. So this is why we could see that the Buddha's teaching, as we find it in the Nikayas, is always very systematic. For example, when the Buddha gives a discourse, he'll begin by saying, I will teach you the three kinds of this or the four kinds of that. Then he'll say, what are the four kinds? One, two, three, four. Then he'll take each of these four items. And what, O monks, is number one? What is number two? What is number three? What is number four? He explains each of them. Then he sums it up at the end. So you can see it's very well ordered, very well presented. So this is why it's said to be with the proper phrasing. And then the teaching affirms a brahmacharya, a holy life or a spiritual life that is utterly perfect or complete and pure. Okay, so that is the way of describing the Buddha's teachings. And now this is the way the monk goes about the learning. So it says, such teachings as these he has learned much of, remembered, mastered verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. We have five aspects of learning mentioned here. And these five aspects actually constitute, you could say, a complete course in education, or a complete course in intellectual training. So first, the teachings, one has to learn much of them. And the word that's translated here as learn much of is, in Pali, it's bahusutta, which means literally heard much of. Because in the Buddha's day, the teachings were not written down. And so nowadays we describe somebody who is learned as a well-read person. But in the Buddha's day, we say that somebody is a learned person is one who has heard much. So to learn the teachings, the first step is to be present, to be in the presence of a teacher, and to actually hear the teacher expound the teachings. Okay, then when one hears the teaching, if one is not sufficiently attentive, the teaching will, you could hear much of it, but it will just come in one ear and go out the other. So what's necessary is to remember the teachings, or to retain them in mind. And in the Buddha's time, you know, nowadays, our faculty of memory has become atrophied to a great extent. It's lost its precision, it's lost its retentiveness, because we've come to depend upon the written word. And so as we rely so much on writing, on reading and writing, we don't use our memories very much. And for that reason, very difficult to remember things. But in the Buddha's time, because there were no books, and because especially the religious specialists didn't have books to rely on or writing, they couldn't sit there taking notes. So they had to develop the capacity for memorizing, to the point where after listening to a discourse, even for a whole day, one will remember everything that has been said. It could be it could astonish us, but even now there are, well, in India there are Brahmins who know whole books of the Vedas by memory. And in Burma especially, there are monks who know whole Nikayas by memory, and some monks who know the whole Sutta Pitaka by memory. And even a few monks, maybe enough that fit, be counted on one hand, maybe two hands, who know the entire Tripitaka by memory. So they usually test them by, in order to test their memory, they have to pass a test. And of course, to become like a Tripitaka expert in Burma. But you can't test the person by saying, okay, start at the beginning of the Tripitaka and let's hear you read it through. Because you'd be sitting there for months and months listening to the person recite. So how do they find out that the person passes and gets the degree of being a Tripitaka expert? What they do is to just take books at random and read a paragraph, and they then say to him, continue. Then he has to know the place where the paragraph is being read from, and as soon as the examiner finishes, he has to pick up immediately and continue. Then to make sure that he knows several, if he's, say, being tested to become an expert in the four Nikayas, then they'll read passages at random from the four Nikayas. If he's to be an expert in the Tripitaka, all three baskets, then they'll read passages from all three of the baskets, the Vinaya, the Sutta Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka. And he has to be able to pick it up. But there are some who can do that. When I visited Sri Lanka in 2006, I met one from Burma. When we left the guest house where we were staying, he stopped us and said, oh, I forgot my watch in there. I'm only joking. But even though this feat might seem very amazing, but what one finds, you can try this if you like. If you practice memorizing a little bit, at the beginning it's difficult, it seems impossible, but as you go on with it, practicing day by day, week after week, month after month, the capacity of memory gets trained and strengthened. Just like somebody who wants to, you know, become a track runner, if you ask him to run for an hour at the beginning, he thinks, oh, that's impossible. But after training, he could run for a whole day and not feel too tired. Okay, so one trains the memory. Then to keep a grip on one's memorization, what is done is what this is called mastering the text verbally, which means that one recites it out loud. So one has to go over the text again and again to recite it verbally. What's done in the Buddhist countries, at least it used to be done, at night there would be these hallways or outside these walkways, and the monks walk back and forth with just the path lit by a little kerosene lantern, reciting the text that they've memorized over and over for an hour, a couple of hours. And in this way the text gets imprinted on the mind so that one doesn't lose it. Okay, so those three are actually concerned with, you could say, the learning aspect. Hearing much, retaining in mind, reciting verbally. The next two are concerned with using one's learning to build up panya, or wisdom. So the fourth step, one has to investigate the teaching with the mind. That is, one has to understand it and sort of raise questions about it. What is the meaning of this? What is the meaning of that? Why is this said in this place, and why is that said in that place? How does this part of the sutta cohere with that part of the sutta? Okay, and so now one is working to get, and how does this discourse apply to one's life? What are its practical implications? How does one utilize the sutta as a set of guideposts for training? So in this way, one is investigating with the mind in order to draw out the meaning from the vyanjana, from the wording. And then it's not enough to have simply a conceptual or intellectual understanding, but one has to gain direct insight into the teaching. And that is what is covered by the fourth step, that one penetrates the teachings thoroughly by view, by insight, by wisdom. Okay, so those are what we call the five steps of the classical Buddhist education. And then Ananda also was not only very learned, but also he was a gifted expounder or teacher of the Dhamma. And so he brings that particular skill into the discourse here, and he says that he teaches the Dhamma to the four assemblies with well-rounded and coherent statements. What is meant by the four assemblies? Anybody know?
The Sangha, Bhikkhu, Bhikkhuni, the lay people, and the people.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, the Bhikkhus and Bhikkhunis, monks and nuns, and Upasaka and Upasika, the lay men and the lay women. So he teaches well-rounded and coherent statements. The statements have to be, you know, reasonable, balanced, properly expressed. And then the purpose of the exposition is for the eradication of the anusaya, the underlying tendencies. What are the underlying tendencies? All seven of them. Dina, you want to take a shot?
Thank you.
Anybody like to take a shot at the seven underlying tendencies?
Greed has to be in there somewhere. Greed.
It's not, the word greed isn't used. Let me see if I can get that. I think I have it. Somebody want to try? Not allowed. You saw there was a note number and you looked at the note, right? Okay, we find them at Sutta 18. Let me test myself. You look at 18. We see whether we're going to flunk Bhante, kick him off the seat. Bhante, you have to get the right order also. If you get the order mixed up, you lose points.
No, please have mercy.
Kamaraga. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that's sensual lust. Patika, that's aversion, the underlying tendency to aversion. Ditti, dittanusaya, the tendency to muse. Bhavaraga, the lust or craving for existence. Is that there? Is it there? Oh, that's there, okay. It's just Bhavaraga, mana, conceit, vichikicca, that is doubt, and avijja, ignorance. Was the order correct?
No.
Doubt is views and then doubt is next.
Views comes before doubt. Yeah. So views, doubt, and ignorance. Views, doubt, conceit, and ignorance. Okay, anyway. We're getting them right. In the wrong order. I could give myself A minus. Okay, anyway, this is the purpose, to eradicate the underlying tendencies. And one who has fully eradicated the underlying tendencies is fully liberated or an arahant. Okay, so Ananda says that this kind of bhikkhu could adorn the Gosinga sal tree forest. Okay, then Sariputta turns to Venerable Revata. We have Venerable Revata also amongst the stone statues. And Venerable Revata was appointed by the Buddha to be one of the foremost disciples. What was he foremost in? What was his specialty?
Meditation.
How'd you guess?
I didn't.
I mean, how? You knew it.
Well, I had read the footnote.
Yeah, that's cheating. You're not supposed to read the footnotes.
I thought that's why they were there.
You can read them, but not while I'm testing. Okay, so Sariputta turns to Revata and says, "Friend Revata, the Venerable Ananda has spoken." The text uses the expression, I think it's yattapatibhana. That's according to his own idea, his own intuition, his own what inspires him. So we could say his own inspiration. And now I'm asking you, what kind of monk could illuminate this Gosanga solitary forest? And then Revata says, here a monk delights in solitary meditation. He takes delight in solitary meditation. I don't remember what I was trying. What Pali word is being translated as solitary meditation? Could have been patisalana. Okay, he is devoted to internal serenity of mind. This is ajatang cheto samatha. So this means that he practices what is called samatha meditation. the meditation for calming the mind. And the practice of samatha meditation aims at samadhi, at deep concentration. So he is devoted to internal serenity of mind. He does not neglect, the word here is jhana. So he practices the jhanas. He enters the first, second, third, fourth jhanas. He possesses vipassana, that is insight. So he also practices insight meditation. And he dwells in empty huts. That is, empty huts are considered the ideal place, or one of the ideal places for practicing meditation. The small huts in the forest, so through the hut one is protected from rain, humidity, mosquitoes, snakes, biting flies. Okay, so Revata praises the monk who delights in meditation. Of course, all the monks, in order to achieve any kind of realization, one has to practice meditation. But Revata was probably one who didn't specialize much in learning or in preaching, teaching the Dhamma. But he was fond of going off into secluded places deep in the forest in order to continue to develop meditation, even after reaching liberation. Okay, now they turn to Venerable Anuruddha, and they ask Anuruddha what kind of monk could illuminate the Gosinga Sala tree forest. Among the stone statues, does anybody know which one is Anuruddha? Who's Anuruddha?
Which one is, or who was it?
Which of the stone statues?
I can't remember. No, I can't remember which of the
no. Do you know, Bowie? No?
Fourth one to the left.
Fourth one to the left. Going up. What is the fourth one doing? Did you get it? No. One of them looks like he's sleeping, right? Do you remember? It seems to me, this is just my hypothesis, that somehow in the Chinese tradition, the identity of Anuruddha may have gotten mixed up with the identity of Moggallana. Because in the Pali Suttas, Moggallana, before his attainment of arhatship, had a problem with tinamita, with sloth and torpor, or dullness and drowsiness, and he would doze off, and the Buddha had to come to him and sort of stir him up and goad him on to practice. And so maybe if the identities got mixed up, we have Anuruddha. That's just my hypothesis. I don't know, otherwise I don't know how to explain why Anuruddha seems to be asleep. I remember years ago reading in the, it's called Vajrabodhisi, the magazine from the city of 10,000 Buddhas, Venerable Xuanhua said that, and obviously he's speaking from a knowledge of a Chinese tradition, maybe even North Indian tradition, that Anuruddha had gone blind, but that he had the divine eye. But there's nothing in the Pali tradition that indicates that Anuruddha was blind. And quite to the contrary, there are some texts of Anuruddha traveling alone, which would have been difficult for him if he was blind. But his specialty was was called the Dipa Chakku, the divine eye. And this is the special kind of faculty of spiritual vision by which one can see events taking place at great distances, even in other world systems and in other realms of existence. And so when Amaruta is asked the question, then he replies, "Here, friend Sariputta, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, a bhikkhu surveys 1,000 worlds or 1,000 world systems. Just as a man with good eyesight, he might climb to the upper chamber of a mansion or a palace, and then look down, he might be able to see with his eyes 1,000 wheel rims. I don't know what the wheel rims would be doing out the palace. Maybe they had factories where they produced wheels for chariots and carriages, and they would, when making them, they would lay them out in a field. But this man would survey with his vision 1,000 wheel rims. And just so, this monk with a divine eye might survey 1,000 world systems. And it's interesting that the text uses this image of wheels to describe a world system, because I'm sure that many of you have seen photographs of galaxies taken with these very powerful telescopes, and what do many of them look like from a great distance?
Spirals.
Yeah, but a spiral is just like a wheel. I don't want to say that Buddhist cosmology is always 100% like modern cosmology. There are sometimes, we have to admit it, some mistakes or differences in the Buddhist cosmology. But this strikes me as something quite astonishing, this correspondence. Okay, so Anuruddha says that's his conception of the ideal mind. Okay, now they turn to Venerable Mahakasapa. This kind of standard image of Mahakasapa. How does Mahakasapa usually look in the images of him?
Stern.
Stern, yeah. Not the bright, welcoming, pleasant, smiling face, but kind of figure that, when you have to go before him, you feel like a little bit afraid. Because he could read into one's mind, and he will know just about all one's thoughts. I used to know a monk like that in Sri Lanka. He was actually a German monk who was an observer of the ascetic practices, the Dutangas. And we used to call him the Mahakasapa of the present era. He since passed away in 2005, 2006. In his 90s, he passed away. But when he first became a monk, he lived for, 11 years at the place called the Island Hermitage. This is an island in a lagoon in southwest Sri Lanka. And he almost never left the Island Hermitage, but always stayed there. And he was, at that time, he was very closely associated with Venerable Nyanamuli, the translator of the Visuddhimagga, who was alive. This would have been in the late beginning from about 1953 on till 1964. He stayed at the Island Hermitage. And then in 1964, he felt that he had enough of staying fixed in one place. And so then he made a determination that throughout the year, except during the 4 months of the rainy season, he would always keep on traveling without any fixed abode. And so he did this. Each year, 8 months, he would always travel. If he found a place that he liked, he would stay there for a few days, maybe even a few weeks. He never traveled by bus or by car, always traveling by foot. He had walked the length and breadth of Sri Lanka quite a few times. This was before the war broke out, so he would travel from the north, Jaffna in the north, down to Matara in the south, from the west coast to the east coast, no fixed abode. And sometimes he would have to come in to Colombo for medical treatment, especially during his later years. And then he would stay in one monastery in Colombo. And when we heard that he was there, we would go to him to get advice from him. But we were always a little bit afraid because he was, I don't know whether stern would be the word. He wasn't so much stern with others, but he was stern with himself. But it showed a little bit in his mannerism. And he seemed to have the ability, I don't know whether we could say that he actually read individual thoughts, but he knew very, very precisely what a person was going through at the time when they would go to speak to him. So his advice was always very precisely tuned to the needs of the person. Okay, so I think Mahakasapa was somebody, this we could say, was somebody a little bit like Mahakasapa. So Mahakasapa describes his conception of the ideal monk. And he mentions what are called in Pali the duttangas. These are the ascetic practices. Sometimes they're called also dutta guna. You could say the virtues, the ascetic virtues. For duttanga means literally the ascetic fact, the factors of asceticism. The word dutta literally comes from a word, a verb which means to shake off. So observing these practices is supposed to be the means to shake off certain defilements, like craving, laziness, discontent. Okay, so here, a bhikkhu is a forest dweller himself. That is, he makes the determination always to live in the forest, not to live in the monastery, in a town, or a city, or even in a village. And he speaks in praise of forest dwelling to others. So you can see even the ascetic monk is concerned not only with his own good by observing the ascetic practices, but also he tries to promote the good of others by encouraging the others in the ascetic practices. Okay, he is an alms food eater himself and speaks in praise of eating alms food. Actually, we use the word pindapata, comes to be used generally to describe all of the food that is given to a monk or a nun. We say that it's all pindapata, which means alms food. But in a way that's, maybe we could say it's a polite lie or polite self-deception, since the real meaning of pindapata is food that one gets by going on alms round from house to house. And this is an institutionalized practice in some of the southern Buddhist countries like Thailand, Burma, maybe Laos, Cambodia. So every day people come out of their houses, they prepare a large quantity of food, they set up a little table outside their house with pots of food on it, and then the monks come walking by, and as they go by, they'll scoop some rice into the alms bowl of the monk, and then take a little bags with some biyanjana, some curry, or some prepared dish, and put it into the bowl or into a separate container. But the real old-style Pindapata is going without any people expecting one in advance, so that one just turns up at the door, you know, unexpected, and then the people have to get whatever leftovers they have and heat it up and offer it to one. Or sometimes if they're expecting ascetics, then they'll have something prepared, but they keep it in the house, they don't set up a little table outside because they know that a line of monks is going to go by. Okay, so one who accepts, one who undertakes this practice makes the determination not to accept food, to accept invitations to the houses for a meal, not to accept food which lay people will bring to the temple or monastery to offer. So sometimes lay people will make an arrangement with the monastery to bring food on a certain day. So all of the regular monks will, they don't go on alms round, but they just remain in the temple, knowing that on that day the lay people will prepare, will bring a meal, and usually they prepare very delicious, sumptuous food. But if the monk has made this resolution to eat only the alms food, he won't stay behind for the lay people to come, but he'll go out from house to house collecting the food. Okay, so this was another practice Mahakasapa observes and praises to others. Then he is what is called a refuse rag wearer and speaks in praise of wearing refuse rags. Okay, now, the normal kind of robe that monks wear is a robe which is prepared in advance, like this robe, you know, some person had bought it in a shop. Like in the Buddhist countries, they have what are called monk shops, which are shops that specialize. They have robes, alms bowls, sets of what they call the eight requisites.
Divine eyes.
Divine eyes. These, like, what do they call them? The straight edge razors. It's a little boring, you know, because there are changing styles for monks. But they have Buddhist, yeah, this is what they also have, Buddha statues and little models of stupas, in which they put sometimes relics and other precious items. You have to get an American company to go in there. You know, they'll change the style every season so that really turn it into a profitable business. Okay, so those are like ready-made robes. And even in some of the monasteries, the monks will receive new pieces of cloth, white cloth, which they then cut up, sew themselves, and then dye and wear. But one who makes the resolve to use what are called the refuse rag robe, this person goes, usually they go to the what's called the charnel ground, where they wrap up corpses. I hope you people don't get afraid. They wrap up corpses in white cloth and discard them in the charnel ground. So then the monk who wants to make a robe will go to the charnel ground and cut off pieces of cloth from the corpses and then bring them back and sew them together, wash them, and then dye them in order to make a robe. Okay, and then he's a triple robe wearer. That is, he uses only the three basic robes. There's the under robe, which is like a skirt, the upper robe, which is this robe. Then there's something like, it's a double thick robe, basically the same shape as this, but usually we fold it in half and we use it a little bit like the shawl when it gets cool. But then one is entitled to use, you know, several of each robe. You know, one could take an old robe and then one uses it for when one is washing the new robe. But somebody who makes the determination to use only three robes won't have that extra, those extra robes. But if he's washing the robe, an upper robe, then he'll wear the double thick robe. And if he's washing the under robe, then he has actually a bathing cloth, which is the same shape, and he'll wear the bathing cloth while the under robe is being washed and dried. Okay, so these are the ascetic practices. And then Mahakasapa also speaks about certain more inward virtues, and these build up in a progressive order. He starts that the monk is one who has few wishes himself and speaks in praise of fewness of wishes. You know, not to have desire for excessive possessions. He is content himself and speaks in praise of contentment, secluded himself and speaks in praise of seclusion. He is aloof from society himself. This could be a little misleading. I think now aloof is not such a good choice of words. Of course, it suggests, the word aloof suggests some kind of cold condescension. But that's not what is intended here. It's rather that the monk is not one who likes to mix and socialize very much, but he prefers seclusion. Then he is energetic himself and speaks in praise of arousing energy. He observes virtue or the precepts himself and speaks in praise of the observance of virtuous behavior. He attains to samadhi, concentration, and praises concentration. He attains wisdom and speaks in praise of wisdom. And he has attained to liberation himself and speaks in praise of liberation. And he has attained to the knowledge and vision of liberation and speaks in praise of the knowledge and vision of liberation. So this is the way Mahakasapa praises the ideal monk. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether there are any questions. Okay, Richard. Okay, let's take Matt. You're closest.
The Arhats who develop the divine eye, in other monks, there seems to be a process by which you can reach this kind of level of attainment, but the divine eye just seems to be something that you either possess or don't possess.
Yeah, but that actually isn't the case. There is a process or a method sort of described in some texts for attaining it. Of course, it helps if one has a natural aptitude for it. But the texts speak about first gaining the four jhanas, the four meditative absorptions, and then what one is supposed to do. The method is actually described in detail in the Visuddhimagga based on the tradition of the ancient commentators. What one does is develop the jhana, excuse me. One develops the jhanas based on the perception of light. So it's focusing on a bright light and then gaining deep absorption into that light. And then based on that light, one extends that light over greater and greater distances. And as one does so, it illuminates those distant areas. And then one could extend that light in such a way through the appropriate determination that it will illuminate other realms of existence that are ordinarily invisible to us.
Earlier you had said that all the different statues have different expressions which are that, you know, which exhibit their personalities. And perhaps also intelligences. What would determine intelligence? Because if there is rebirth, what determines the intelligence factor? The memory factor you talked about.
Yeah.
But the intelligence factor is something I was interested in.
Yeah, I would say probably study, investigation, inquiry, using one's intellectual faculty would do so. And probably also a certain degree of merit would promote the intelligence.
At the stage that perhaps I'm at, when you think about penetration of view.
Think about?
View. You're always operating from some view.
Yeah.
And the understanding is that everybody's right in their view, from what I understand.
That everybody's right in their view.
In their perception of how they are viewing whatever they're viewing.
You mean everybody thinks that they're right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, how would one undercut one's own... one would just look at one's own view as just coming out of your own causes and conditions and resting at that, and then...
I mean, this question takes us a little bit away from...
It does, yeah. I know. Okay. It's just...
I think to get what's called the right, at least from the Buddhist point of view, the right view, one has to have, well, I would say the understanding of the principles of the Dhamma, both through learning and through insight. Just to put it very simply in a nutshell. Okay, I'll just take one question, then I want to finish the sutta, go back and finish the sutta.
I have two simple questions about the second paragraph on 5, when Ravana is speaking.
Yeah.
Because a bhikkhu delights in solitary meditation and takes delight in solitary meditation.
Yeah.
Are those supposed to mean two different things, or is that a repetition?
It's just the way the Pali language is used. They're really the same thing, but one uses one grammatical form, the other a slightly different grammatical form. But the words are the same.
Okay, and second, what is the point of dwelling in empty huts? Are those huts that have been deserted? Huts that people have built and then they move to some other newer place?
No. These would be huts that are built in the forest, especially for the monks to use for meditation.
So it just means being a forest monk.
Yeah, but we could take this in a very broad sense to also include in a bigger building, it would be like a quiet room. So any place which is quiet, where one has privacy, where one is able to undertake a practice of meditation without being interrupted and disturbed. In a broad sense, that could count as an empty. It's actually sunyagara, literally means an empty house rather than hut. But usually what is built are huts. Okay, so those are the two questions then. So let us go now to the next question, the next one to speak. So now Sariputta turns to Moggallana and says that each has spoken, now it's your turn. And so Moggallana describes his ideal monk. He says, two bhikkhus engage in a talk on, the Pali uses the expression here, Abhidhamma. And I think this is a mistaken translation. Higher Dhamma, as though they're talking about a body of knowledge called the Abhidhamma. This has to go, I've come to a better understanding of how this word is used in the canonical text. Okay, in the canonical text, let me just write it, Abhidhamma. In the canon, okay, as many of you know, at a certain point, Abhidhamma came to. At a certain point, Abhidhamma became a collection of texts within the Tripitaka, and then a certain body of a very technical knowledge, the fine analysis of mental states and factors of existence. And the word Abhidhamma occurs in the suttas, but I don't think it has that special meaning, or that it means a kind of special Dhamma or a higher Dhamma. But rather, what I've noticed, well, I mean, others have noticed this too, is that the word Abhidhamma is always used in relation to disciples who are speaking about the Dhamma, not something that the Buddha teaches. And so it seems to be used to mean that the word Abhi simply has what we would call a reflexive meaning. That is, it means something like about. So they're engaged in a talk about the Dhamma. It's not a talk on some higher Dhamma, but Abhi has a reflexive meaning. It just bends back upon the word Dhamma. So they're having a talk about the Dhamma, and they question each other, and when each one is questioned, they're able to answer fluently, without hesitation, and so their talk rolls on in accordance with the Dhamma. So this is Moggallana's answer. And what's a little bit interesting here is that Moggallana's answer doesn't reflect his own specialization. What is Moggallana's specialization? Yeah, great spiritual power, or we would call psychic powers. Some call them mystical powers or magical powers. You know,
is that the word
iddhi? Yeah, the Pali word is iddhi. Yes. like the ability to
fly through the air, go through the earth.
Yeah, fly through the air, go through the earth, sink into the earth, walk across water, send out multiple copies of oneself to be several places at the same time, walk through the walls. But maybe that would have been, you know, setting the standards, maybe setting up too rarefied a model for the accomplishment of a monk. So Moggallana answers instead in terms of being able to conduct a discussion on the Dhamma. Okay, so then finally they turn to Sariputta, who has been the one who up to this point has been asking the others to state their ideals. And so they ask Sariputta to explain his ideal. And Sariputta says, on page 310, here a monk wields mastery over his mind. He does not let the mind wield mastery over him. In the morning, he abides in whatever abiding or attainment he wants to abide in during the morning, saying at the midday, some in the evening. And what's meant here by abiding or attainment means a particular meditative state. So if this monk wants to dwell in any of the four jhanas, he can dwell in that particular jhana. If he wants to dwell in any of the formless attainments, he can dwell in that particular formless attainment. If he wants to dwell in the attainment of cessation, he could enter cessation. So he has complete mastery over all of these meditative attainments. And then Sariputta compares this to a king or a king's minister, or a wealthy woman on Fifth Avenue, Manhattan, who has a chest full of variously colored garments. In the morning, he could put on whatever pair of garments he wants in the morning, same at midday, same in the evening. And so, in the same way, this monk can enter any time of day into any attainment he wants to. Okay, so at this point, they've all expressed their own ideas. And so then Sariputta says to the group of fellow monks, he says, we've all spoken according to our own ideals. Let us go to the Buddha and question him about this matter and hear what the Buddha has to say. And so they go to the Buddha, they report the whole conversation to him, and the text very faithfully repeats the answer of each monk, which is abridged here. And then finally, and after each one, the Buddha approves and says, good, good. Each one is speaking speaking in the way that's natural to him, since each of these disciples has this particular ability or specialization. So he goes through Sariputta on page 312, paragraph 16. Then paragraph 17, Sariputta asks the Buddha, which of us has spoken well? Then the Buddha says, you have all spoken well, Sariputta, each in his own way. But now let me tell you the kind of monk that could adorn this solid tree forest. Here, the monk has returned from his alms round, and after his meal, he sits down, he folds his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, establishes mindfulness before him, and resolves, I shall not break this sitting position until my mind is liberated from the asavas, from the taints, through non-clinging. That is the kind of monk that could illuminate this solitary forest. So the Buddha here is pointing to a monk who's not yet in our hut, but who sits there and makes that determination that in this very seat I will reach the final goal. So maybe we should all go out now. We could skip lunch today, and the weather is quite pleasant outside. You could find a little place under the shade, sit down, cross our legs, and make the determination. None of us will rise up until our mind is liberated from the taints through non-clinging. But maybe we'll put it off till next week. I'm hungry. Okay, any short questions? Quick questions? Save the longer ones for after lunch.
In this last thing, when the Buddha says this, it's almost the sense that it's immediate.
That it's
immediate. That you might make a determination to sit, but just the resolve itself brings nirvana immediately. That there is no need to go through the jhana, there is no need to develop anything, freedom is right here.
No, not quite. I mean, the monk, well, he makes that resolve, but he would sit there, he would probably enter into the jhanas, unless he's a practitioner of the dry insight meditation. But he has to make a very diligent effort. In fact, in some texts, that kind of resolution is expressed willingly, let, as it goes, the blood and flesh dry up on my body, and let only the skin, bones, and sinews remain. But I will not budge from the seat until my mind is liberated from the taints through non-clinging. But I think we have to be a little careful how we interpret this, because this is, I would say that this is intended for a monk or a practitioner who has already accumulated all of what we would call the supporting conditions. So probably this, a monk who makes this determination would already have mastered at least a few of the jhanas and have already reached high levels of insight, of insight knowledges. And so the monk recognizes that he's very close to the breakthrough, and sort of to push him over the precipice, he has to make that determination not to move until he's liberated. I used to do that when I was in Sri Lanka, but then, you know, after a half an hour, well, the pain, it's just too much. Yeah, tomorrow I'll make that resolution, but now let me readjust my legs. Oh, these mosquitoes are terrible. Let me get up and move inside instead of sitting out here. Let me go up and spray on some anti-mosquito repellent. Okay, let us end for the morning. So we end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Eta vata ca mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampate siddhya sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampate siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampate siddhya Bhagavupadaya vichihe tato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino tukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Yeah, I should just mention that this ends the spring summer semester, so it'll be like about a month break through August, and then we'll have start the class again in, I think it's September 4th, is that the date? And then I will send out the program with the dates of the classes and the suttas that we'll be studying. I'll send it out. Kaidi is here? Yeah. I'll send it to Kaidi and then she will send it to all of you. So if anybody who's not registered with Kaidi, your email address, then please do so. End with three short vowels in Buddha.